Welcome to Cattle HQ, a podcast from industry experts and progressive producers discussing cutting-edge info about the cow-calf sector to keep cattlemen and women in the know and positively affect their bottom line.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Cattle HQ. Today I am joined with my colleague Kiernan Brandt, as well as an organic farmer out of Madison, South Dakota, Aaron Johnson. Aaron, would you mind just giving us a brief introduction of who you are and a little bit about what you do before we get this episode rolling?
I appreciate it, Olivia. Aaron Johnson, I'm an organic farmer from Madison, South Dakota. We farm south of Madison. And from what I'm told, it's been organic since 1976, before I was even born. I guess the way it started was that my dad and his brother, Uncle Bernie, decided that they were going to give organic farming a try. And my dad was a little wishy-washy about the whole organic thing. He saw that a guy could go out there and spray some chemicals and the weeds would die. He thought that was pretty neat. And now, mind you, like I said, 1976, there were some pretty harsh chemicals out there, some really bad synthetic fertilizers that are quite caustic. But so my Uncle Bernie solved that problem in one saying. He told my dad, morally, you don't have a right to put that on the land. And then right then and there, my dad said, okay, we're organic. So my dad recalls one of the last chemicals they ever sprayed was Furadan. And if anybody knows anything about Furadan, it's an oxygen inhibitor and also can break down your nervous system. So they would go out there and spray Furadan over the top of a cornfield with an airplane and find dead birds, dead raccoons, let alone the microbial life was suffering from it. And it still was only about 75% effective. So that was one of the major reasons why they decided to become organic. So we've learned a lot of things since the 1970s. And again, like I say, this was way before I was born. We've got a pretty good handle on things. So I guess I can give you a quick overview of what our normal crop rotation is, or unless you got other questions, Olivia.
No, absolutely. Go ahead. You can just continue to tell us a little bit about yourself, and yeah, we'll get questions from there.
Yeah, just tell us a little bit, like kind of what, how you guys rotate, what you guys do with the stuff that you produce. I'm stoked to have you on because, as our listeners are quite aware, I know absolutely nothing about farming, and am just blatantly trying to do my best at scraping by. So I'm always intrigued to learn a little bit more about it.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Kieran. A little shameless plug. We do an a Johnson Farms tour every about every August, the end of July, August time. So keep your eyes and ears open for that. We've had traditionally around 50 to 60 people such as yourself that are interested in organic farming and how we do it. Now, what we do doesn't always work for the next guy and in the next area. So you really got to develop what works for you, what your work efficiencies are and equipment's available to you. So there's a lot of pieces that are involved in that. So again, a little shameless plug there. We're happy to take people on our charter bus. We rent a charter bus and show them the fields. And granted, it's a snapshot in time at that time. So it's a season long, it's a multi-season faceted, type of operation that we have. So getting into the operation itself, if we were to take over a piece of ground, first thing is that it takes 36 months from the last known prohibited substance to be called organic. You have to farm it organically, and you have to abide by the organic standards, which are set forth by the federal government. And once you reach those guidelines, then after 36 months, then you're able to sell your product as organic. Otherwise, it's subject to the conventional market. I like to say that our fields, year number one, season number one, we plant oats underseeded with alfalfa. After we harvest the oats off of that, in the fall of year number one. The alfalfa is waiting for us in year number two, and we keep it there in year number three as well. So that's the first 3 years of our 6 year crop rotation. So on the fourth year, we raise soybeans on that ground. And then after the soybeans are harvested, we'll sprinkle some winter rye out there and chisel plow that in as a green manure cover crop. And now year number five rolls around in the springtime, we will incorporate that winter rye crop using a field cultivator and plant our corn on those acres. And then in year number six is back to soybeans. Now we're at year number seven, we start the process over. So we have a 6 year crop rotation and we raise four cash crops on there, and the winter rye is a cover crop. So this process has been developed by my cousins with great success. Now there is still some hand weeding that still needs to be done. It's not perfect, but neither is anything else out there that I know of. So there's a lot of benefits to this type of rotation. All of our fields are broken up into 1/6 of this rotation. So it's not like all of the entire farm is in oats this year. The next year, it's not all in alfalfa. So it's all divided equally into the 6 year rotation. So the beauty of that is that, well, there's a number of things, and I'll probably forget some things. I kind of wish my cousin Charlie was here with me to help explain it as well. But it really spreads out your workload throughout the entire season. You're not so much in a time crunch with everything getting done all at once when it's time to plant, when it's time to sow, when it's time to harvest. So all summer, all spring, summer, and fall long, you're busy with doing something, and it spreads things out. It also has a great impact on reducing weeds and diseases and insects. You're constantly keeping those pests at bay by keeping things guessing. Another aspect of it is that in our situation, we have small fields and small equipment, which is a good advantage to us. Some of our largest fields, there might be a handful of them at 65 to 70 acres, but I bet if you took a calculator to it, on average, our fields are around 40 acres. So in one quarter of land, you could have four different fields. So you have 40 acres of corn right next to it. You have 40 acres of alfalfa, and 40 acres away, you got soybeans. 40 acres away, you got oats. So alluding to that 6 year rotation as well, I had said that we have oats, alfalfa, alfalfa. Well, the first 3 years of that crop is all solid seeded crops. So our wind erosion, our water erosion is greatly reduced by having 50% of our acres in solid seeded crops. And a good chunk of that is there in the wintertime as well to prevent any of that wind erosion during the winter months, when years like this year, there isn't a whole lot of snow cover in our area to hold the soils in place. And then the last 3 years are in row crops. So, which requires a little more tillage as well as mechanical work there. But in all of our soil tests, we're able to maintain and increase organic matter. We're roughly around 5% plus in our organic matter. So we have healthy crop residues. So the microbes in the soil, the earthworm has plenty to eat and thrive. And I would say the correct balance of pests available. We're not 100% pest free, but they just don't surpass thresholds. You ask anybody, you go out there with a sweep net and start counting insects that you gather in a sweep net, they just don't get out of control in our fields. So
does that fluctuate from year to year, or is that stay relatively consistent? You can keep them pretty pretty controlled through that type of management.
This process, this 6-year rotation has been in effect for 25, 30 years, if not longer. And it doesn't really change with the markets. The only thing that really changes is the field sizes. As the years go through, we may have a couple of fields, some larger fields that may happen to fall into a soybean production. So we have a few more bushels of soybeans to harvest, a few more acres, but otherwise we really stick to that crop rotation schedule.
I imagine. Yeah. That rotation had to come with a lot of trial and error to get that kind of dialed in and figure out what was the most ideal, especially when it sounds like you guys were reclaiming some stuff and getting it certified as organic.
Right.
Is that a third party process that they have to like come in and audit that and make sure that everything's up to snuff?
Yeah. So there is a national organic standard, and then there's private companies that administer these organic certifications. So I have to pay on my farm, I have to pay just about $2,000 a year to go through all of the paperwork and have a third party person come out here to prove that I don't use chemicals on my farm. So seems a little backwards to me, but I'll digress.
There's always hoops to jump through. Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. So you mentioned that you start with rye and alfalfa. Is that right?
Oats and alfalfa.
And so how has that really streamlined your guys's rotation in maintaining, I guess, when you're converting stuff to that organic production system, in really setting it up to be successful and then just kind of transitioning it into being a productive functioning portion of your farm, I guess.
Sure. If we were to take over some conventional land, we look back on their history and depending on what they've been growing in the past, if it was a corn and soybean rotation, we don't automatically say we're going to plant all of this to oats and alfalfa. We look back, maybe they had alfalfa on that ground. Maybe it was a CRP ground, traditionally CRP ground that comes out of the CRP contract, the Conservation Reserve contract. A lot of those acres are already certified organic because they've surpassed the 36-month threshold unknowingly. So some of this ground, they decide not to renew their Conservation Reserve Program acres and decide to farm it again. Well, that's a great opportunity to consider organic farming. So now your previous crop was grass. So maybe you want to consider a broadleaf crop like soybeans. So I kind of forgot your question. I got a little sidetracked there.
No, that's pretty thrifty. I hadn't even thought about that. That's a good, I guess that's a great way to have some unmolested, undisturbed acreage that is ready to go out there and be productive if it's done nothing but house duck nests and roosters for the last decade.
Yep.
No, I was really just wanting to get on. So, I mean, I guess one advantage of doing things in this type of rotation is probably, I guess like for me, being a young guy with limited farming experience and not having a farming operation to return to at any point, the idea of having to purchase expensive equipment to have to go out and deliver nutrients to the field is a pretty daunting concept to me. So how does this, doing it the way that you guys do it through your rotation, how does that set you guys up better to manage the long-term health of that ground?
Yeah, I got distracted there because you were saying a young guy as yourself. I don't have a good answer. I'm sorry I'm digressing from your question again, but I really don't have a good answer for an individual that has a real desire to come and farm. I feel terrible because it is really expensive to farm. The land values, the equipment values, especially now, the used market on equipment is astronomical, and the land is with it as well. I wished I had a better answer for you, but I honestly really feel like royalty. I really feel like I had the right last name and I was born into a kingdom. I hate saying that. I don't want to say that stuff because I know there's better farmers out there, and they may live in the cities and they may not have the capital, but they got the time and the talent and the energy to do it. I really feel like I was put into a good position here, and I don't know if I really deserve it, honestly. I think that there's the other organic farmers that are way better than I could ever be. And I'm not trying to be self-deprecating or anything like that either. It's just terrible that things are so expensive and the money that it takes and the capital. So, I apologize.
Well, that's why we do it on this type of a platform, is we have time to digress and talk about whatever we want.
Yeah. So I guess if someone does have a burning desire, the best thing to do is build relationships with the landowners and just work your hardest and get involved in that way. So it's not impossible, but it's going to take some good hard work and some good luck on your side. And, you know, with luck is from when opportunity meets experience it's just those opportunities that evolve from all of that. So
that's right. And being able to capitalize on it. No, I think you raise a great point. I think one of the themes that we're going to be able to observe over this next generation in agriculture is really kind of some segmentation, some separating of the men from the boys, and who can adapt on the fly and be innovative and creative and stay relative in their production practices and do it in a way that keeps them profitable. And yeah, it's definitely going to be an interesting uphill battle for those that are coming into it without some of those resources that make it easier to transition and get stuff off the ground.
Yeah. You know, earlier you're talking about our rotation as well. Believe this kind of answers your question. So the beauty about the rotation is that the physical characteristics of these crops that we raise, if you were to draw it out on a map, I realize this is a podcast, but if you were to draw it out in a graph, not a map, but if you graph it out, say you put your crops on the left-hand side and then across the top, you put some of the characteristics of it, like a cool season grass versus warm season grass. Cool season legumes, broadleaf crops, solid seeded versus the row crops. Once you graph that out, you can start checking off a lot of these boxes. And the more boxes that you check off wherever, say, oats intersects with solid seeded crop, you put a check box there. Soybeans is a legume crop and it's the row crop, you put another check mark in that box. The more check marks that you can get, the better off you are. Oats underseeded with alfalfa, you can plant that very early in the season. So when we feel like it's fit to go, we're going to go. We're going to put that oats and alfalfa in the ground. It's a cool season grass. It can handle, it wants that, those cool nights to stimulate its growth. We've learned that with corn and soybean planting, you really just got to wait. We don't like putting anything in our area until after Mother's Day. So my cousin says his best advice on planting organic corn and soybeans during the month of May is to don't do it. Go take a fishing trip. It's just get away. It's really hard seeing the neighbors flying up and down the fields. But we've learned that corn is a warm season grass. And soybeans, they do well with the heat as well. We've learned waiting for that soil temperature to get nice and warm and have good warm days ahead of you, that the crop will outcompete the weeds. And we've tried planting before where it's cool, or you think it's going to be warm, but it ends up turning cool and the crop just stalls out and the weeds just keep right on going. That gets real frustrating. So.
Well, and you had mentioned that what percentage of organic matter did you say you have?
We're hovering that 5%.
5%. So you've already you've done some of the work to get some of that moisture retention in that soil. And so waiting until it does get warmer is probably beneficial as well, too, at least in my mind. And to me, it's really interesting to see how yes, you guys farm organic, but you've really gotten into this kind of rotational, or not even so much cover crop, but just almost, I guess, in a way, cover crops. Maybe I'm getting way in the weeds there, but to start building that organic matter and the soil health. And I don't know, it's almost like you're combining it's not even that you're combining the two worlds. I think everybody should be thinking about that, but I think there's benefits both ways.
Mm-hmm. And there are, you guys are eliminating inputs by combining those things and making one crop tie into the next crop to benefit the soil's resiliency to winter, to benefit the soil microbes' presence that following spring. You know, it's that systems thinking that we always love to circle back to when we're talking about extension things, but really that forward thinking and setting, not thinking about that snapshot in time, but thinking about what the snapshot's going to look like next season.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm just more recently dabbled in cover crops and soil health and, you know, organic matter. And it's like, the more you learn, the more questions you have and the less you really know about it all. And so it's just fun, like talking to you and hearing how you organic farm, but you're really truly taking care of the soil as well in this whole entire process. And so, yeah, like Kiernan said, it's this whole systems thinking that all just kind of comes together. It's really fun to listen to. And honestly, when you were going through your years and I had to write all these down, you know, you have your oats and your underseeded alfalfa, and then you go to 2 and 3. I thought we'd come to year 7 and you'd be like, we give it a rest, you know, like going back to some of those biblical times, you know, you give that 7-year rest. But I think this is really, really neat, the setup that you guys have going on. So,
well, and they do give it that rest because you let that alfalfa establish for a year, right? And then take it off in year 2.
The alfalfa is there in year number 2 and again in year number 3. Yeah, it stays there. There is crops on the acres every year, you know, barring natural disasters, flooding or drought. So yeah. Yep.
Sure. Kiernan, I don't know if you have any more questions relating to the crop rotation.
I was going to ask about fertilizer. So are you guys taking fertilizer out there? Are you managing that through grazing on residue, or what does that look like?
We do supplement with pelletized poultry manure. And so we get that from a broker and it comes in on semi-loads, and we spread it out with a dry fertilizer spreader. So it's not a completely closed loop system. So we do supplement with that. And then also our non-certified cattle, we don't have organic certified cattle, but the manure produced from those cattle can go out onto our fields. So
okay. So sorry to interrupt you. So how does that work per se? So they're not certified organic, but you can put them out on the fields for natural fertilization. So do you have to, like, is that a process too, or I guess, how does that work?
No, they're just simply not in our certification for our organic label. So they are asked when I fill out, I just got done filling out the paperwork for my organic certification and I submitted it. Now, if I made mistakes or if there's other questions, I still have to go through that. So I'm still in the middle of getting that done. But they ask about the livestock that is raised on your operation and whether you want that certified organic or not. Any product that comes from livestock, whether it be my own or the neighbors or some other place, they need to know information about that if that gets applied to my ground. So that gets to be, I don't get involved in that part of it. I don't take anything from the neighbors and apply it to my stuff, but the certified organic composted poultry manure that I use, that's certified organic as well.
So if you were going to be certified organic beef, what kind of, I guess, what would that look
like? I looked into it a little bit and it just didn't seem to fit my operation and my strengths. I'm more of a crop guy than I am a livestock guy. Now, I may be way off on this. You'd really have to ask somebody that is a certified organic with livestock, whether it's chickens or beef or pork. I think you need to do some micromanaging on their feed, and you also need a lot of room for them. If they are in too confined of an area, disease can spread through them quite quickly. And again, I'm kind of talking over my head, so I really shouldn't say, but I just know that I think if I were to have a herd of certified organic beef, they would all be in quarantine. They would all they would all be getting treated. And I know that's one of the things that you need to do as a good cattleman and as a certified organic beef producer, that if anything does show any diseases or any problems, you need to quarantine them and treat them ASAP. So, which I think is standard procedure for anybody raising beef. But we take a more proactive approach and do preventative medicines. And so, but one thing we don't do is we don't do any hormones injections in our cattle. So, but we do things like the 7-way and the five-way shots, Dectamax Poron, prevent any skin diseases, lice,
parasites. Yeah, some of that topical control. And right. You know, I think a lot for folks that are considering going into the organic side of the livestock production, you really just have to put a lot of consideration into being set up for it on the front end to avoid those problems. So like for organic cattle production, like you want to make sure that you're not running into issues with a lot of hoof rot or pink eye breakouts where you're put in a situation where you have to make that judgment call. Well, do I compromise my program and mass vaccinate, mass treat the pen, or do I let these animals kind of sort it out on their own? And in my experience, avoiding those problems rather than having to make those judgment calls is always a lot better. Mm-hmm. But also being in a position where going through those additional steps of verification and documenting where you're getting your feed from and pen requirements and all those things, making sure that you're set up to capture the value on those animals once you go through all those additional costs. Right. And that can require some modifications to how long you're keeping your cattle, to the facilities, not only for your cattle, but for your feedstuffs. I mean, there's a lot of variables that go into that, because typically if you're going to be paid a premium for organic, you're either backgrounding those calves to 800-900 pounds or hanging on to them and feeding them out and direct marketing somewhere where you're being rewarded for those additional steps. And that takes some time and some planning to transition to, but right. You know, I never discourage guys from thinking about it, but yeah, there's definitely some more work. But just like the farming side of things, I'm sure once that method of production has been in place and all the kinks have been trial and errored out after 20 something years of doing it, it just becomes the way you do it, you know?
Yeah. And our area is really good for crop production as well. Pasture is kind of hard to come by in our area. We don't have a whole lot of hills and draws and river bottom or anything like that. It's a nice, relatively flat, rolly hill, prairie pothole that works out well for crop production. So space gets to be an issue. Like I say, the land values are high and you can do a little better on raising crops than raising cattle on those acres. Unfortunately, I got land payments to make. So
something that I was curious about. So with no spraying, no herbicide and pesticide management, have you guys seen just an increased amount, or I guess that's probably relative since you've been doing it for so long, but and abundance of wildlife and some other of those things that come along with kind of letting Mother Nature just run its course in those little micro habitats?
In our operation, I have about 720 acres of land that I either own, rent, manage, whatever. 530 of that is tillable land, and then 83 acres of it is pasture ground, and then the remainder is the house, the bin site, the farmyard, trees, meadows, whatever else have you. My cousins are even larger farmers than me. I think they are about 1800 acres of tillable land, and I don't recall how many acres of pasture they are. But in that operation, there's four families working together to make that all work. And if you put all of our acres together, you're well under 3,000 acres. And that might be, in our area, that would probably be enough for a father and a son operation. We farm those acres organically, and we're able to have five families on that operation. So when Kiernan asks things about increased wildlife, everything thrives on our farm, including the families that work the land as well. So whether it be the desirable things on your ground, the crops that you want, and even the undesirable things. And fortunately, the undesirable things that thrive on our ground, they always stay in check and don't completely wipe us out, whether we're talking, and I'm talking referring to diseases and insects and weeds. So they always stay in check, and they're not perfect. Don't get me wrong. Nothing is on any farm, but it all does stay in check.
I remember going to grazing school this last summer, and I learned so much. I mean, I haven't been in that arena since range management camp back in the FFA days, but just a really, really great learning experience, and being able to appreciate all of those plants for what they are, whether they be desirable or undesirable. And I remember one of the takeaways that I took back from grazing school was that whether it be a cow or a sheep or a goat or a deer, there's, regardless of the plant type, there's typically at least one day a year that they'll eat that plant. And those plants out there can tell you a lot about the condition of that field, the condition of things consuming that feed that's available in that field, the overall health of your soil and things like that. And just being able to not necessarily get freaked out when you see a weed out there. And I'm sure you guys have to do a lot of that if you're out there hand weeding, but being able to just kind of assess what that means as an overall indicator for that patch of ground.
Definitely. It's something that we deal with on a year-to-year basis, and depends on what Mother Nature throws at us. We had a tough 2021 with the drought. Our crops didn't do a great job of canopying over, and weed pressure was enough. Spent some money on hand weeding those things and spending time with the row cultivator and rotary hoe, doing the best we can. We've had better years in controlling weeds, but fortunately, like I said, 50% of the acres are in solid seeded crops. So those do a really good job of choking everything out. We didn't have 100% of our crops and row crops that didn't canopy. So that really spreads your risk out and your exposure out to inclement weather years.
I have kind of a dumb question. So do you really truly get out there and hand weed?
Oh yeah. These?
Okay. And oh, yeah. I guess, like, what does that look like? How often do you do it? Who gets to do it?
Yeah. Yeah. We got to, if anybody wants to come and experience it.
Well, I'm not opposed. I just, I don't know if we always think about that when we think about organic farming. Yeah. So.
Yeah, whenever we plant our row crops, like I say, we try to do it when the soil is nice and warm and we're going to have some warm temperatures ahead of us. And we typically will rotary hoe those crops. This is mechanical tillage now. We'll rotary hoe those crops probably within 5 to 7 days of planting, and then kind of keep on that cycle. 10, 15 days apart, rotary hoeing, and then once the crop gets large enough, about 2 or 3 inches tall, maybe 4 inches tall, then we'll be out there row cultivating, and we like to row cultivate at least twice. So in all of our row crops, our row crops are 30 inches apart. Well, when every row gets walked. So there's a human footprint every 60 inches. So you have a row on your left and a row on your right. And then those are the two rows that you hand row. And then when you get to the end of the field, you turn around and you jump over and you have a row on your left and then a row on your right. So literally every row is going to have a human footprint beside it, whether it's corn or soybeans. The oats and the alfalfa, the alfalfa is such a good crop that chokes out the weeds. And the weeds that we clean up during the row crop years really reflect in the oats years. You just don't see oats being very weedy at all. And so the oats are really clean weed wise. And then in the alfalfa years, we take 3 cuttings a year typically. And so there isn't a whole lot of weeds that survive when you take 3 cuttings each year, and you take that times 2 years. So you got 6 cuttings out there, and you bale those up and remove any potential weed seeds if anything does develop, within 3 cuttings of a year. So, and those get put into a round bale and run through a cow. And so isn't a whole lot of weed seeds that survive that.
Just another question. So in my YouTube rabbit hole endeavors that I get myself into, I was watching this YouTube video on like a no-till garden, and they had made a comment that, you know, they'll pull all these weeds and they'll pull them from the, you know, from the root, or they'll pull the root up because those weeds won't come up the following year. So if you're pulling these weeds from year to year, do you have less weeds from year to year? Or I guess, what does that kind of look like?
Yeah, I don't know where these weeds come from. that's one of the great questions in life. Where do these weeds come from? We've had some,
probably Canada with some of that wind we've had lately.
Yeah, it's like that field was so clean last year. Where the heck is all this coming from? So that's Mother Nature though for you. Whenever there's a scar on the land, whether you do tillage on the ground, that's Mother Nature's way of covering up that scar with a scab. And weeds are so good at covering up scars like that. And so it's trying to learn to work with Mother Nature in that regard, that that weeds can tell you a lot about what's going on in that field.
I think that's a really neat way to look at it too.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. You know, that Mother Nature, you know, if we listen to Mother Nature, she can tell us exactly what's going on. It's just being willing to listen. But I think when we do, then we're going to be able to kind of reap the benefits of that land that we're taking care of. So I really like that.
And Olivia has 3 rugrats at home that I am sure she would be happy to loan you for the entire summer to go out there and do some hand weeding.
Hey, I'm not opposed. So Aaron, you let me know when that's going on. And in fact, I would just like to see it being done. Like, I know I sound very naive in all this, but I've never seen somebody walk a field and pick weeds. So
doesn't get a whole lot of attention. It's not.
No.
It's not something that gets advertised very well, but kind of like rock picking out in the fields. It's one of those jobs that my dad says it's only as much fun as you make it.
Someone's got to do it.
I remember rock picking when I was a kid. So like I said, I'm not opposed to weed picking. And in fact, I'd bring my 3 munchkins out there because it'd be good for them. But yeah, I think it's just one of those aspects of organic farming that doesn't always get that much attention, like you said, but it's a very real part of the whole organic farming endeavor. So
yeah, we try to do what we can from the tractor side and with the crop rotation as well to minimize those hours in the hot sun and in the cool mornings with all of the wet soybeans rubbing up against you, getting you all wet. I'd like to give another plug to Northern Plains Sustainable Ag Society. They put on an organic conference every year up in Fargo. It seems like it was in Aberdeen for years, but then they moved it up to Fargo, bigger venue, larger area there. That is usually at the end of January every year. And then the granddaddy is for organic conferences. It's called MOSES. I might get the acronym screwed up here, but it's MOSES, Midwest Organic Sustainable Education Society, I believe. And they just had their annual conference in La Crosse, Wisconsin. So if there's any interest, I highly invite you guys to check out those organizations and find find a diverse group of organic farmers out there. You might find somebody that's somewhat in your area that's got good advice, a good crop rotation, and even maybe some opportunities to acquire some land to rent or own, and equipment options as well, livestock. Possibilities there with pasture and livestock numbers as well. So they're a pretty tight knit group, and there isn't a whole lot of organic guys in the country. I should say guys and gals. There isn't a whole lot of organic people in the country, but they converge on these conferences, and it's nice to hook up with these like-minded individuals, and you know, stranger things have happened. You might learn something.
Yeah. And I think it's invaluable that as you go through this process of kind of carving off your niche of what works, it's always just absolutely essential to have those mentors and those people that you've been to their place and had those conversations with them and seen how they do it effectively. I mean, that's really where learning takes place. And we'd be happy to put both of those association pages in the show notes for today's episode. And we'll have to stay in touch for your guys' field day this year, because we'll have to collaborate and figure out a way to knock two birds out with one stone on that.
Yeah. Yeah. If I can add a little bit more to this, one question that we get a lot is with our organic grains, where do we take them for market? You know, obviously our local elevator is conventional, so we won't be able to get conventional, or we wouldn't be able to get organic price for our organic grains when we send them to the conventional market. So we have small grain bins, which work out well for us, because like I say, one out of every 6 years is our corn crop. So we only need, we don't need these huge 90,000 bushel grain bins. So we're able to use a number of small organic certified, well, they house organic grains, so they don't need to be cleaned every year. So you have to have your own grain bin situation set up. And then in my case, we use a marketing agent called NFO, National Farmers Organization. And they line up the buyers and the trucking. And I just need to be in contact with my marketing agent. And I just got off the phone with them here this morning, had an hour long conversation with them and talking about selling my soybeans. I got a contract for organic soybeans for $36 a bushel. And my oats were at $7 a bushel. Corn is $9 plus. I haven't gotten all my corn contracted yet. So, and I don't mean to say those numbers just to get people excited either. So if you want to be an organic farmer, don't do it because you want to get rich, because it's probably not going to happen. Do it because you love it. So, but I want to say that working with NFO is got to be one of the top priorities if you want to be an organic farmer. Working with a marketing agent, not necessarily NFO. I like NFO. We've been with them since 1961, and they've treated us so good over these 50, 60 years. So the benefits of working with a marketing agent, they are on the job for you 8 to 5, maybe even 7 days a week. This is their job. You can focus on what you do best, which is growing crops and raising cattle and dealing with your family, and let the professionals market your grain. So that's another plug I wanted to put in there.
I appreciate that, because I was thinking about that too, talking about some of those prices. So I appreciate you bringing that up. Kiernan, anything else?
No, that was good. I was going to ask that earlier and it slipped my brain, but I imagine that's an important part is just, you know, you're going to be supplying a niche product that, I mean, obviously you guys have found strong demand for that product, but yeah, it may be more abstract marketing than just taking stuff to your local co-op. So definitely making sure that, that if folks are considering that, being aware that that is going to be a component of having to line up that steady demand for the value-added product that you're producing.
This is a really fun conversation. So thank you, Aaron, for being with us today on today's Cattle HQ podcast. Thank you to all of our listeners. We'll have some of this information up on today's show notes, and we'll catch you on the next Cattle HQ.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Cattle HQ, brought to you by SDSU Extension, headquarters for all things beef. We invite you to visit extension.sdstate.edu for the latest beef information, as well as subscribe to the show on Spotify. You will also find show notes and resources from today's episode. Until next time, remember, success is not a goal, it's a byproduct.